Lecture 3, Long Distance Trade, Jericho and Châteauneuf.
Still trying to sketch in a frame for the particular kind of Neolithic culture that marked Western Europe, and especially Britain, which is the purpose of this course, the direction of this course anyway. This lecture is going to present two more Southwest Asian Neolithic cultures, which show the remarkable range in technology and in other aspects of human lifestyle, which were typical of Neolithic culture in its Western homeland. Great deal less range in southern Britain by the time the Neolithic legacy reaches there. But to understand the peculiar characteristics of the British version of the West European version of the Western Neolithic tradition, I think it's important to look at the homeland and to look at the vast range of possibilities which were worked out there. One possible cause of that maximum diversity maybe the existence of long-distance trade in such commodities as obsidian, textiles, ceramics, ceramic figurines for decoration, as well as pots for useful purposes, as well as, of course, in grains and animal products. The site of Jericho in Israel or Palestine, depending on current political redefinitions, was inhabited for several millennia by a remarkably old-fashioned culture, which was very slow to accept changes in technology or general lifestyle, despite environmental degradation going on at a terrible pace around them, and at the increasing rate of such changes in many of the cultures surrounding and impinging upon Jericho's territory. The chief alteration in the lifestyle of Jericho, according to the material evidence which we have available, was in fortification. They developed impressive walls to protect their much-attacked and frequently destroyed settlement. Châteauneuf in southwestern Turkey, and I apologize to any Turk for my pronunciation, was much more than a village, even more so than Jericho was, really more even than a town with its 5,000-plus inhabitants. We should probably give in and call it a city. Jane Jacobs, writing in 1970 on the nature of the city, has proposed some very interesting definitions for a village, a town, and a city. A village is a place where people simply attend to survival, producing food. A town is a place where people do that, but also at certain times of the year or moments in a broader time space, produce something that marks it off. But this doesn't go on all the time. It's a sort of temporary export activity. A city lives from its production and its exports, even more than from its imports. And it attracts to itself the food production, which it does not directly carry out, or at least not as exclusively carry out as much as villages do. Okay, we should probably give in and call Châteauneuf and also Jericho cities in their way. First settled at the beginning of the 8th millennium, about 7,000 BCE, Châteauneuf lasted 4 millennia, finally being abandoned for no evident reason. Its matriarchal earth religion was fully developed, and the quality of its crafts, which I think we really should call arts in many cases, made them objects of long distance and highly profitable trade. Jericho first. Jericho is some 700 miles southwest from Jarmo, across the rivers of Mesopotamia, across the Syrian desert. It overlooks the Jordan River as that river flows into the Dead Sea. Today, Jericho is an abandoned man-made mound composed of some 20 layers of settlement. The earliest village was settled about 8500 BCE. It grew into town and city status, if we like those definitions, and then shrank a bit and was finally destroyed by an Egyptian army about 1560 BCE. By then, the town or city had developed a local reputation for its fortifications, which were impressive indeed, especially in view of the extreme simplicity of the inhabitants' lifestyle. Archaeologists haven't found yet any traces of the Jericho, the walls of which are described so vividly in the second chapter of the biblical book of Joshua. That town would have been destroyed by the invading Hebrews in the 13th century BCE, some two centuries after we know the Egyptians ended the last of the Jerichos that we can find archaeologically. Perhaps the name Jericho was by then locally applied to any settlement with impressive walls, or perhaps the survivors of the Egyptian destruction of two centuries earlier had migrated to a new site which has not yet been discovered. The physical types of the inhabitants of all 20 levels of the 7 millennia of Jericho's existence are remarkably unvaried. 3 racial types have been found, but the great majority of them were a short, slim, long-headed people, the typical adult males just over 5 feet tall, The typical adult female is just under 5 feet tall and probably quite like modern Palestinians in coloration. The earliest houses at Jericho were round, stone and plaster imitations of the circular tents or stick huts of a hunting-gathering society. 3,000 years later, about 5,500 BCE, the people of Jericho, very likely the descendants, some of them at any rate, of the original settlers, had taken to building rectangular stone houses with very thick walls covered with coats of fine white plaster, not unlike the shining houses for which the Greek islands are famous today. Later, the people of Jericho returned to the roundhouse style, building them side by side with rectangular houses. The people of Jericho had an artistically evocative cult of the dead, attested by skulls covered with delicately modeled clay masks, something like death masks, perhaps, or perhaps in death the person took on a new visage, a new character, if only we could interpret what the meaning of these beautiful objects were. Grim a bit, but beautiful as well. Aside from their walls, their houses, and their death masks, the material culture of the people of Jericho was both exquisite and minimal. A stubborn survivor of the lifestyle that had brought Mesolithic humans to the threshold of agriculture in the favorable conditions that followed the neothermal climate change of the previous millennium. Jericho was situated in a beautiful zone of live oak and pistachio forests, with cedars covering the mountains, patches of fig trees here and there, and wild grain and berries growing in profusion on the hillsides and the flatlands. Game animals like gazelles, the fearsome wild cattle, boar, and foxes came regularly to the banks of the Jordan and to the local springs, where they could be easily trapped. The climate of the first millennium of Jericho's seven-millennium existence was less dry than now, and all that foliage as ground cover made the most of the seasonal rainfall. In such an environment, the people of Jericho had little incentive to develop more than primitive agriculture, or wear more than minimal clothing, and apparently no shoes or sandals. Pottery came late and sparsely. Baskets and wooden vessels must have seemed good enough to this simple people. Even as their environment became less favorable over the next 6,000 years, the people of Jericho held on to their old ways, which may have attracted or perhaps outraged all those enemies who kept destroying the town but could not obliterate it until armies with trumpets and chariot-riding commanders became the arbiters of quieter people's destiny. Well, if Jarmo represents the dynamic early agricultural village, and many-layered Jericho represents the persistent survival of even simpler patterns along with the development of amazing new things like walls and exquisite death masks, the next major phase of Western Neolithic culture is splendidly revealed by the excavations at Çatalhöyük in what is today south-central Turkey. Between 7,000 and 6,000 BCE, 12 layers of settlement were built on that 32-acre site with a probable average population of 5,000. That density of settlement made it an extraordinarily large town for its time, a proto-city. And this mound is accompanied by a smaller mound at its side, which has not been excavated, nor its population estimated, nor its relationship to the larger mound guessed at. Few, if any, of these rebuildings seem to have been caused by warfare. They were caused by fire. The climate was dry. The wood used in the roofs was highly flammable. Sometimes the inhabitants seem to have built one house on top of another without destroying the previous one, even without benefit of a fire. So determined were they to stay with their ancestral homes, focusing on the physical fact of their cohesion. The site was attractive enough, though not extraordinarily so, nothing like Jericho. The mound grew atop a small hill in the middle of a fertile upland plain 3,000 feet above sea level, ringed by mountains of volcanic origin, including one active volcano. From those neighboring mountains, the people of Çatalhöyük mined obsidian, the valuable black natural glass, actually lighter than black in that particular region, which was a profitable item of long-distance trade all over the Near East, all over this homeland of Southwest Asian Neolithic culture. Farming the typical Southwest Asian crops must have been easy. It's clear that, however, that the types of wheat and barley that they used at Çatalhöyük came from wild ancestors several hundred miles to the east in the Taurus Mountains, now separating Turkey from Syria. So this is an already established type of foodstuff which is brought in. There's no local domestication evident in that side of their food supply. But rather than accumulating many domestic animals, which would have been easy on the plain above which Çatalhöyük rises, the inhabitants, for some reason, relied for their main diet-supplementing meat source on hunting. Hunting also provided the leopard skin pelts, which were the main formal garment of the people of Çatalhöyük, and an important motif in their religious art. The people of this densely settled town were mostly of two racial types, evidently living in harmonious coexistence leading to intermarriage. The majority, roughly 60%, were long-headed or dolichocephalic race, to use the technical term, a long-headed race suggesting the current Mediterranean type, not unlike the predominant population at Jericho. The minority, some 40%, were of stockier build with rounded heads, which are called brachycephalic heads. We can speak of the long-headed dolichocephalic and the round-headed brachycephalic people to use some of these wonderful archaeological terms. This racial type is sometimes called alpine because this type can be seen all the way from Armenia through Anatolia through the Alpine mountains, indeed to western places bordering the Atlantic like Brittany, and certain Irish populations also seem to be alpine. By the second stage Neolithic that we call the Bronze Age, these different races had mingled in the European world, in the European scene, but we can still identify a Mediterranean group, an Alpine group, and often a mixed group as well in these two important, I think we have to say, proto-urban Near Eastern settlements. The skeleton of the people of Çatalhöyük show very little sign of variation or of new blood beyond those two stocks over the 1,000 years of settlement. The average adult male was about 5'8" tall at the beginning and at the end of that 1,000 years, and the average adult female 5'4". And this would be true both of the dolichocephalic Mediterranean Çatalhöyükers and of the brachycephalic Alpine inhabitants of that difficult-to-pronounce place. These Neolithic people lived longer lives than their Paleolithic forebears in the region had. The average life expectancy reached 30 years of age or a little more, and certain individuals as old as 70 have been found in the very revealing burials of this community, about which more in just a few minutes. These burials also provide evidence of class differentiation. There is a clear difference in class structure in this community. The houses in all levels of Çatalhöyük shared walls, just like the Pueblo villages of New Mexico. And like the Anasazi forebears of the modern Pueblo dwellers, the people of Çatalhöyük entered their houses from the roof by ladders. In a way, these houses suggest man-made caves, even more womb-like than natural caves, because the dead were buried under the beds on which the living members of each household slept. Imagine the dreams of which these people were capable. The bones of these ancestors were reverently wrapped in interestingly patterned textiles after the cadavers had been exposed to the elements for some time, a burial process called excarnation, which we will meet again in Neolithic Britain. Typically, there are many types of burial practice, but quite common are inhumation, in which a body is placed, bones and flesh, into the ground. Cremation, in which, of course, the body is burnt and the ashes perhaps collected. And in between them is excarnation, in which the body is exposed to the elements, so the flesh will rot away or be carried away by vultures or whatever, and then the bones are reverently collected and brought to one or another place, obviously held in esteem, indeed reverence, by the people. In Çatalhöyük, they were wrapped up in these interestingly patterned textiles, which are very like modern kilim designs of Anatolia. So here we have a very ancient, continuous art. It's easy to see why this community was so reluctant to leave their hearths, to build a house on top of a house rather than even move over. And very difficult to explain why they finally did so, apparently all together, apparently without the pressure of conquest or plague or any other kind of traceable disaster. The interiors of these square houses show us what crafts the people practiced and how they saw their world. Paintings of men hunting, of their volcanoes smoking, of leopards and bulls and other favorite animals in a variety of designs, along with geometric figures, and most suggestively of all, of their mother goddess and her attendants, had been well preserved. I'd like you to read you the description of what is probably the most striking painting in Çatalhöyük, a landscape, a description given by James Mellart, the British archaeologist who excavated there some 40 years ago, and who remains the great interpreter of the site. This is a little slightly rhapsodic description, but I think it certainly represents the impact that the sight of this painting must have made upon Mellart and his team when they first uncovered it. He speaks of a single wall painting which more than any other illustrates the artistic genius of the people of Çatalhöyük. Mellart is pro-Çatalhöyük, no question about it. Painted on the north and east wall of a shrine of level 7, soon after 6200 BC, according to radiocarbon dating, it represents that rarest genre of early painting, a landscape, and needless to say, it is unique. In the foreground, of course, Mellart only excavated about 14% of the town. We do not know what artistic treasures lie beyond that. In the foreground is shown a town with rectangular houses of varying sizes, with internal structures reminiscent of the Çatalhöyük houses that have already been indicated. Each house has its own walls, and they are placed one next to the other without any open spaces. The rows of houses rise in terraces up to the top of the mound. Beyond the town, and much smaller as if far away, rises a double-peaked mountain covered with dots. From its base, parallel lines extend. More lines erupt from its higher peak, and more dots are grouped beyond its right slope and in horizontal rows above its peak, interspersed with horizontal and vertical lines. It's a very complicated design, perhaps not clarified by this heightened prose. A clearer picture of a volcano in eruption could hardly have been painted. The fire coming out of the top, lava streaming from vents at its base, clouds of smoke and glowing ash hanging over its peak and raining down on and beyond the slopes of the volcano are all combined in this painting. It's not difficult to localize this picture. Hasan Dağ, which rises to 10,673 feet, is the only twin-peaked volcano in central Anatolia, and it lies at the eastern end of the Konya Plain within view of Çatalhöyük. The central Anatolian volcanoes became extinct only in the second millennium B.C. Moreover, these volcanoes, and Hasan Dağ especially, were the source of much raw material, and particularly obsidian, for Çatalhöyük, a source from which the site probably derived much of its wealth. It may be surmised, says Mellart, that it was not only for its great cutting power, its transparency, reflective power, and its jet-black appearance that this material was so highly prized. Its volcanic and thus chthonic origin would have linked it to the underworld, the place of the dead, and thus it was a true gift of Mother Earth, and therefore imbued with magical potency. These considerations, Mellart concludes, may help in explaining why an artist late in the 7th millennium B.C. recorded the wonder and awe of a volcanic eruption against the foreground of the town of Çatalhöyük on the wall of one of its shrines. If the picture is unique, so is the occasion, and probably only at Çatalhöyük had Neolithic people reached the necessary degree of civilization or possess the artistic genius to record such an event for posterity. Well, with such art, we can make some fairly secure guesses about the religion of this Neolithic city. 40 shrines have been uncovered at Çatalhöyük so far. James Mellart, the British archaeologist who dug there in the 60s, worried that he might have uncovered the shrine section of the city. If that turns out to be the case, even so, that density would be striking anyway, and its concentration would suggest that the priestly class lived together, rather than in dispersal throughout the rest of the population. If the rest of these layers of proto-urban settlement show anything like the same density of shrines, we will be able to conclude that this proto-city was intensely religious, more so than other Neolithic sites suggest their inhabitants were, at least in the Near East. In Western Europe, the religiosity of the people of southern Britain is quite remarkable. But it's a very different kind of religion. From the layout and furniture of these shrines, and the bones of the priestesses buried in them, it seems pretty obvious that the religion of the people was centered on women and directed by them. And if the religion was, the rest of what we call politics likely was too. Çatalhöyük may well have been the site of a matriarchy, of a matriarchal state, or proto-state. And why not, with a population density of that size, relatively greater than anything for hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles around, why not call it a state as well, and not simply a proto-state? The most recurrent image in the art of Çatalhöyük is a large, heavy, older woman who has been identified by Mellart and others as the goddess, the mother goddess. It's hard to miss the appropriateness of that interpretation. Sometimes this mother goddess is shown seated on a throne in the act of delivering a child. In this pose, she often leans for support on two great cats, presumably the leopards, who were then still widespread in the region. We should remember that at that time the lion, the Asian lion, was an infrequent but certainly impressive visitor in the area that is now Turkey and Greece and Bulgaria as well. It would take some time before that dangerous creature would be eliminated. Sometimes this lady is accompanied by another younger woman and a child, but the younger woman is not always slimmer. These ladies were either remarkably well-fed, if these are realistic presentations. Maybe the women of Çatalhöyük were as well-fed. Their bones will not tell us. Or perhaps the kind of immense adiposity, which is the clear mark of these women, is a sign of their divinity. Clearly lean, it was not better. It was certainly possible to be too thin in that culture. We see mother, daughter, and child, perhaps. Certainly we see mother, daughter, and child. Do we see goddess, lesser goddess, and the child who is indistinguishably boy or girl? We can't tell yet which this child will become. The goddess is sometimes depicted with a male figure, who may be her consort or her son, and who usually has a beard and sits on a bull. And the bull is clearly the sign of male sacrality, whereas figures of perfectly recognizable human females are all over the place and have been identified with religious cult. Very few images of men are available. When they do appear, they are usually riding on a bull or some doing something otherwise fairly improbable. And it's generally assumed that the male principle is represented in this community by a symbol, by a lion of the male type, by a bull, by bull horns, by something perfectly clearly Freudianly phallic. Interesting that there is this hesitation to represent the male when there's no hesitation at all in representing the female. So those who speculate that we may have the beginning of a matriarchal religion and possibly a matriarchal political structure have a lot to go on. The art is very suggestive in this direction. If only the art that the Neolithic Britons left at Avebury and at Stonehenge and around were anything like as suggestive, we would be less mystified by the significance of these remarkable structures than we are. The dominant colors, red and black, may well represent life and death, Mellart says. On the other hand, they may simply represent something like skin and hair color. Men are much more constantly red, consistently and more darkly red in this art than women are. And this may perfectly well be a representation of the fact that men were very active in hunting and in a certain amount of farming and wore relatively little clothes in that warm climate. Men tended to be darkly sunburned. It's very typical of Egyptian art, early Egyptian art, that the male figure will always be well tanned and the female figure always very white, a sign of her leisure and of his activity. And their hair may well have been black. Mellart spends a certain amount of time going back and forth between these two possible interpretations of the meaning of this art. Is it realistic? Is it representational? Is it naturalistic, or is it entirely symbolic? One of the other interesting things about the religion of Çatalhöyük is that the people there avoided bloody sacrifices. In fact, there's almost no sign of any kind of bloody sacrifice. Instead, small packets of grain or of tools, the fruits of these skillful people's labors, were offered on the shrine's altars. Also noteworthy is the curious absence of pig, wild or domesticated, in the diet of Çatalhöyük. There are many jaws of wild boars, which are inserted into the walls of these houses, which Mellart has called shrines. But the other bones of pig, which you tend to find in kind of middens and garbage heaps, where the bones of eaten animals are flung after the consumption of their meat, pig bones are very rare there indeed, and it may be that wild boars of the region were hunted, killed, their heads removed, and their jaws brought into the shrines. Interestingly enough, in most cases, the jaws of the wild boars are covered by clay depictions of the female breast, as ample as is the rest of the anatomy of the women of this culture. Very striking connection, hard to know what to make of it. But the absence of pig, which was perfectly available as a meat, in the diet, or not the total absence, but the relative absence, is very striking. One has to wonder if this could be the earliest indication of the pork taboo that would become so important a feature of Jewish and Muslim religion. One has to wonder where the inhabitants of Çatalhöyük went when they all left, apparently all at once. They must have gone somewhere. If they headed south, could we find there, perhaps, remote forebears of the Hebrew cult, which distinguished itself from its neighbors by this very distinctive pork taboo, which was then picked up by the religion of Islam, which liked to think of itself as the truest daughter of the Hebrew revelation. The crafts of Çatalhöyük are really outstanding. Jewelry was manufactured for trade as well as local use, and the jewelry, of course, makes the most of obsidian. Obsidian is this fascinating material, this volcanic glass, which is remarkably sharp. You can perform surgical instruments of modern refinement, surgical operations of modern refinement with obsidian instruments. And it would appear that obsidian instruments a little bit later and elsewhere would be used in such delicate activities as trepanning, that is, performing a surgical operation on the skull, either to remove pressure, possibly to remove tumors. This sort of thing was done even by Paleolithic forebears when they began to use obsidian as well. So it's a remarkable material. But the very fact of its sharpness means that it's very brittle. So to shape it in anything other than a blade is extremely difficult. And yet the people of Çatalhöyük would do that. They would take obsidian, this hard and brittle stone, and other stones closer in structure to granite, though not granite actually, and they would make beads with holes going through the beads, so very, very fine that modern pins are very difficult to insert within them, which also tells you that the kind of thread which was used or the kind of wire which was used was itself of a remarkable refinement. Well, probably thread rather than wire, because no trace of wires has been found, and much of the thread would, of course, have eroded away by now. Some of those great Kilim rugs have not eroded, but this kind of random textile would be very likely not to last for very long. Pottery came late in the sixth layer. In other words, about halfway through almost. So rather like Jarmo, Çatalhöyük was at first aceramic. But once they picked up pottery in imitation of their neighbors, they executed their pots beautifully. And not only was their pottery used locally, but it was traded. And one can track the trade routes and the patterns and see how many miles away the China, so to speak, the pottery of Çatalhöyük was appreciated by other Neolithic cultures in the area. In fact, there's a considerable difference in the style of pottery produced in different sections of the city. Melar thoroughly excavated only about 14% of the city, and feared that he had hit the priestess quarter, the shrine quarter. But there were sort of sample digs in other portions of the mound, and there it was clear that the western part of the city produced a style of pottery that was much more vivid in its kind of linear decoration than was the pottery produced elsewhere in town, at least according to these initial digs, these initial probes. So it's a very complicated story, just like everything else at Çatalhöyük. Perhaps most striking of all are the textiles. Skillfully dyed and woven in complex designs, very like those of Turkish kilims today. But that is putting it a little bit too simply. There are lots of kilim-type designs. There are also remarkably curvilinear designs suggesting a style of textile decoration that would appear only millennia later in Iran and become part of a typical Persian curvilinear style. There are lots of different styles which are woven into these woolen textiles. The people liked carpets, which is hard to imagine they didn't export as well. And so we might have expected that the production of carpets to be a craft of pastoral nomads rather than of a settled agricultural community. In fact, many of the Oriental rugs made today are indeed just such a product, the product of a nomadic people. Although it's easier to loom a carpet, of course, when you're staying in one place. But many nomadic people moves from one pasture area, where it stays for several weeks or even months, to another pasture area, again, a semi-permanent, semi-sedentary settlement, and there more weaving is done than while they're on the road. But we see not that pattern at all. We see a city not only agricultural, but highly urbanized, which is the earliest site of this oldest of human crafts. The Oriental rug, after all, is still one of the world's favorite commodities for long-distance commerce. So many questions about Çatalhöyük. And one of the most interesting ones for the whole, this overview that I'm trying to give of Neolithic cultures is the question of its size and its sophistication. Could the quality and the aggressive promotion of the crafts and trade goods of Çatalhöyük help explain why it became by far the largest human settlement in its context, a big city in the Neolithic world of Southwest Asia? Nothing of that magnitude, at any rate in urbanity, would ever be produced in Neolithic Europe.
Lecture 4, The Neolithic Moral Revolution.
This lecture deals with new social and moral formats that were introduced by the Neolithic Revolution and which have survived in one form or another even into the present day. It deals, in other words, with forms of social life, types of role models, and values, individual and collective values, that began to make human life and interaction much more complex once the simplicity, the relative simplicity of hunter-gatherer society gave way to the Neolithic Revolution. These new forms have been with us ever since in one way or another, usually gaining in complexity rather than simplifying, at any rate, until the series of revolutions that got going with the French Revolution towards the end of the 18th century of our era. This lecture will discuss chieftainship first, then the rise of social hierarchies, matriarchy, patriarchy, polygamy, both polygyny, which privileges males, and polyandry, which privileges females. And finally, perhaps possibly most importantly, the diverse roles allotted to children once agriculture replaced foraging as the basic food source. Perhaps the basic theme of this lecture, as of the social, political, and ethical phenomena it discusses in very general and rapid terms, is conflict. The rise in conflict is also one of the durable consequences of the Neolithic Revolution. Now, this is, I hope, clear from the little case studies of Jarmo, Jericho, and Çatalhöyük in previous lectures. Neolithic technology led the way to profound changes in human society, in politics, in religion, in role modeling, and ethical values. First of all, chieftainship arose in the Neolithic era. The state was yet to come, but chieftainship, a sort of situation of political control before the state, was a major step in that direction. Now, whenever we start trying to talk about Neolithic politics, we run into serious trouble because we don't have written documents. Or then the written documents often clash with the technical terms we're using. For example, in the 16th century, when the Spaniards came to the New World, they encountered in Mexico and in Peru the highly organized Inca and Aztec empires. The Inca Empire in Peru, even more brilliantly organized than the great Aztec military state in central Mexico. Now, technically, the culture of the Aztec and Inca empires was Neolithic. They used stones, not just for construction, but as their basic tools. The weapons of these two very military societies were basically flint weapons. Metal was used for decoration and for a certain amount of monetary exchange. So really not even monetary exchange very much. Turquoises and cocoa beans and so on were more valuable as items of exchange. So the Inca and the Aztec states were Neolithic states, if you want to use that technical term describing the tools as a universal kind of category. Exactly the kind of thing that Gordon Child objected against, because to call the Inca Empire Neolithic is to pose all kinds of problems of credibility, very different from the other Neolithic societies we meet, for example, true Neolithic societies in the center of New Guinea today, where we have something that is the material archaeology of which, the art of which, shows that it is very closely kin to the kind of thing that got going around Jarmo and the kind of thing that was established in Britain in the period we're dealing with. There's a brilliant book by Robert W. Service called The Origin of the State from the Anthropological Point of View. And what he does is take the historical records that Englishmen and Dutchmen gave us of the development of the Zulu chieftainship into the Zulu state under the role of one great chieftain, one great big man chief. And we also have the good fortune to have English and also French commentary about the Cherokees, whom we can see moving from a situation of chieftainship into a kind of proto-state society, proto-state politics. If we want simply to stick with more traditional sources, we have a very good description of the emergence of a state from chieftainship in the biblical books of Samuel and Kings. And the crucial figure here is David, who is a type we see all over the world, a type known in anthropological politics, if there is such a thing, as the big man chief. I'm told that the basic character in Chinese for a king is derived from the notion of a big man. So the big man figure is a very kind of important transitional person. However, we want to imagine Neolithic chieftainship, we can be pretty sure that it replaced the crisis resolution structures of what we assume to be the hunting-gathering societies from which Neolithic culture evolved. Now, there are about half a dozen hunter-gatherer societies surviving today, or at least surviving into the mid and latter 20th century. One of them in Southwest Africa, Namibia, loosely and rather incorrectly called Hottentot by the arriving Dutch colonists of the 17th century, is represented today by the Kung San, which I could pronounce those clicks, who have been studied by the great anthropologist DeVore, who has studied them in minute detail, studied the physiology of their birth spacing techniques, which are simply habits having to do with nursing, and so on and so on. And his studies go along with the studies of the other five or so surviving hunter-gatherer societies. And what they find is that in those societies, there is a remarkably consistent series of patterns about how to resolve conflict, crisis resolution, to use a more modern term. Those structures were highly egalitarian, the structures of hunter-gatherer societies. Special privileges of decision-making were reserved to the elders, the oldest women, absolutely, as much as the oldest men of the band, or in a larger sense, of the tribe. Sometimes hunter-gathering societies can do so very well. They had a certain group of animals or a food supply of botanical richness that allows them to grow from microband to macroband into something that you might almost begin to call a tribe. In these societies, the only people with privileges in making decisions among the adults are the oldest ones. We know, for example, from some of the Neolithic societies we've been studying that the vast majority of adults died in their 30s, their early 30s, their middle 30s. But there are always a few who live on. We find the occasional skeleton of a 70-year-old, of a 60-year-old. And these, we can assume, were very like the elders whom we meet in these hunter-gatherer societies we can study today. Now, most of these communities are acutely aware of the value of each human life and acutely aware of the value of harmonious relations among their few members. They disapprove of violent resolution of conflicts. They disapprove of capital punishment. They disapprove even of exile. But they would prefer to exile a troublesome, let us say, a criminal member of the group than to kill him or her. They're also unwilling to rely on the superior strength of one or another member of the group. They don't like to tolerate the losses entailed by fighting it out. You can resolve crises by having two disputants simply fight it out. But this, of course, costs. Usually results in the death or the crippling or the damage. A damage to the ego as well as to the muscles and bones of the loser. And this is the kind of thing, of course, that male lions do, that bulls do, and so on. But human hunter-gatherer societies have not wanted to be like that. So such groups do not let an assertive hunter make such decisions or force them upon the group. If such a fighter insists in his way, he is typically ostracized or expelled from the group, occasionally done in. But as I say, the loss of human life is something that tiny societies really do not like at all. Now, the Neolithic population explosion changed all that. Human beings became more expendable than ever before. And various pieces of evidence from Neolithic sites point to the existence of solitary leading men and sometimes women who enjoyed a distinctive status which we assume they either won or inherited. And we tend to call them chiefs, although the more careful anthropological literature, I notice, archaeological literature, tends to put chief in single quotes because we assume that this is the grave of a chief. We're not sure. Here, of course, we need more than material archaeology is going to give us in the way of evidence. We're very frustrated. And so we turn often to the historical novelist, who is now given license to invent and to speculate. One novel that I think does a very good job of this is the novel Sarum, subtitle A Novel of England by Edward Rutherford, very popular in Britain and selling fairly well in the United States too in paperback. Edward Rutherford, in drawing up his picture of Sarum, Sarum of course is the old Latin name for Salisbury, and he takes this to be the name for the whole area in which Stonehenge was built, as well as the place in which Salisbury, the new city, would be set at the 13th century. In this novel, which begins in 10,000 BC, as Hwyl and Uta, husband and wife, are going across to what would be the European continent. They can't do that because the British Peninsula is suddenly sundered from the continent and Britain becomes an island in 10,000 BC. Actually, it wasn't 10,000 BC, it was much more like 7,600 BC, but 2,400 years is not bad for novelists. That's the kind of range of era, the plus or minus thing that we can allow the historical novelist. And they settle around Stonehenge and gradually their descendants discover agriculture. Or rather, agriculture comes in, and the invaders blend with the descendants of our initial people. And you have the reign of a line of chiefs who are called Kronos, an interestingly Greek name. Kronos is the chief of the Stonehenge area, and I think finally the line runs out with Kronos the 80th. But this does represent the guess of anthropologists that a pre-royal, pre-state chieftainship structure did arise typically in the typical Neolithic society, if you can imagine a typical Neolithic society. And that it would also tend to be very long-lived. It would project itself forward. Tremendous stretches of time as one very brief generation follows another. Very different sense of time from that which historical societies have had. When we look at back at Çatalhöyük, what do we see? Almost, we're so tempted to imagine a situation of matriarchal priestesshood and no doubt matriarchal chieftainship. Possibly in a place as important as Çatalhöyük, we might want to call the chieftain a queen rather than simply a chieftain. It's sort of pointless to get precise about terminologies for periods in which we simply do not have written data. Well, one thing is very clear. Social hierarchies arose, and this we can discern by certain differences in burial patterns. Sometimes the burial patterns of men and women are very, very different. Sometimes they're the same. This tells us a lot about gender preference. Sometimes certain individuals are buried with rich grave goods and with great care, and others are not. And from this kind of evidence, we get a sense of the existence of social hierarchies. Now, back in the hunter-gatherer society, the hierarchy was a hierarchy of age within each family or band or tribe. The elders held positions of authority and esteem. This was superseded by a hierarchy of inherited status, according to which younger members of a leading family outranked older members of a lower class family. And one got into the habit, which lasted well into recorded Latin and recorded Greek and into English, even into the 20th century, in which it was all right for a young man of a privileged family to address a much older man of an unprivileged family as boy or something of that sort. When one called waiters, boy, garçon, mozo, things of that sort, which is not polite to do anymore, they were reflecting this kind of hierarchy of status. In the Roman army and in Latin language in general, lower class people are called juniors. Elder class people are called seniors, seigneur in time, lords. And what has happened is that the statements about relative age of being senior or junior are taken and applied metaphorically to social status regardless of the age of the individuals involved. Now, how did these privileged positions of elite lineages arise? Again, we have to speculate. We can imagine that a founding individual's talent as a champion plowman or champion animal tamer, as a war leader, as an economic organizer, especially when you're dealing with something the size of Çatalhöyük or dealing with several villages under one chieftain, any of these talents, including, very importantly, the talent of negotiating with the spirit world, someone who was a champion negotiator with the spirit world, a champion shaman, a champion priest. All of these people could start a family which would then live under the umbrella of their own achievements. Aggressive younger members of such a family, once it was established, might lead groups of the expanding population to found new settlements. We must remember the Neolithic diaspora. Once Neolithic culture spread throughout that sort of upland curve of Western Asia, it then spread out east to Iran, northeast even into Central Asia, northwest to Europe, eventually south even into Egypt and so on. And this great spreading abroad, the spreading of the culture seed of Neolithic culture, the diaspora, was normally led would be the phenomenon which a certain number of the individuals of a village which was getting too large for the village's resources, some of them would take off and found a new place. Who would lead them? Very often a son or possibly a daughter of the leading family. Often they seem to have brought along with them a skull or a thigh bone of an important ancestor. The skull obviously containing the brains. We often find these skulls which have no connection with any of the other bones in a settlement, which seem to be have a sort of privileged burial position. The thigh bone is, of course, a symbol of male potency, and it carries that metaphorical meaning in the Hebrew Bible as well. And sometimes funny thigh bones, which don't fit, and funny skulls appear. And this may be a memory of an earlier connection. But always, although they live in a different place, a different settlement, they maintain the respect for the leading lineage. Now, a ruling family extended by colonization or by conquest could easily evolve into a noble clan which was used to diplomatic negotiation, and it usually tried to reinforce its authority by monopolizing religious functions. It's thought that societies ruled by such hereditary priesthoods, usually termed theocracies, may have been common during the diffusion of Neolithic culture. And that is what Mellart is led to speculate with the case of Çatalhöyük. And one of the alternatives that's presented not in Edward Rutherford's novel Sarum, but in Cecilia Holland's novel of Stonehenge called Pillar of the Sky. Much finer novel, I think, and written simply about that period, about the Neolithic and early Bronze Age period, not about the whole sweep of history of Salisbury from 10,000 BC to the 20th century CE. Matriarchal chieftainship may have been quite common in Neolithic cultures. We certainly suspect it at Çatalhöyük. Theocratic matriarchy made sense in a community like that. We know that males played important roles as farmers, warriors, and craftsmen. There are paintings of men going out and doing what guys do, which is hunting the aurochs, a very dangerous kind of thing. And they wear a special kind of ritual hunting sash, which may have played sort of the role of war paint. And males are often represented in the art, or the male principle is, but almost always symbolically through something phallic like a bullhorn, whereas women are presented in the full opulence of their prosperity and beauty and majesty and sacrality, simply as highly as very realistic female figures. Religious authority was reserved for the women, and why not suppose that political authority was as well? But we don't know that from the material archaeology. We have to guess. Now, why would the prestige of the female have been so strong in some Neolithic societies? The sedentary life was more favorable to women who must have become pregnant much more frequently than in pre-Neolithic times. Hunter-gatherer societies tend to maintain their population, zero population growth, and the endocrinology of this has been studied by a divorce team with interesting results. But Neolithic populations expand and expand and expand. Probably infant mortality increases dramatically also, but the total population expands. And thus you have colonies sprouting off all the time. It may also be that the mystery of childbearing fertility may have become more compelling as the old male hunting magic faded. One interpretation of the Paleolithic paintings in the caves of France and Spain is that it's all about hunting magic and is overwhelmingly male. But the art of Çatalhöyük is about women in the extraordinary act of delivering children. That's what the goddess is doing over and over and over again. Some scholars argue that matriarchy, or rule by women, was less important than matrilineality, matrilineal identity, tracing descent, the lineage, and usually deriving one's name and one's property from one's mother. In such societies, a young man moves into the house of the woman he marries, and then is awarded by the village council a plot of land to cultivate. His wife's brother may be the legally important male figure in his children's lives, the young maternal uncle being more important than the father. And this has been roughly the pattern among the Hopi villagers of Arizona and is maintained stubbornly to the present day in the Hopi reservation. Now, the opposite pattern, patriarchy, much more common. It made sense at least for the nomadic herding clans that arose in the early Neolithic period. It may have arisen in sedentary village cultures as well. A champion plowman, so to speak, may have become a dominant figure. And it certainly wins out in the long run. By the end of the Neolithic period, patriarchy has been firmly established, far more firmly established than it ever seems to have been in hunting-gathering societies. Rule by males must have seemed natural as well as inevitable in mobile societies that depended on catching and herding animals, killing predators, and fighting with rival herdsmen. Cattle raiding has become almost a ritual for such groups. Male aggressiveness was likely valued even more than in the older, simpler hunting-gathering societies. The warrior hero who collected women as well as cattle became a normal candidate for chief. The main job of the women, both native and captive in a patriarchal society, was to bear and raise the children who bore the names and rights of their fathers' families. Very few patriarchal societies are not also patrilineal. Sometimes we find evidence of a patriarchal matrilineal society, presumably the result of an encounter between herdsmen and farmers who decided on collaboration rather than conflict and finally achieved fusion. The males of a matriarchal society might have been ready recruits for a patriarchal change of government, throwing off mama's control, grandma's control even worse, but didn't mind leaving the nurture of the next generation to the women as their responsibility. And we see interesting traces of these in the laws of medieval Germanic people. The Visigoths of Spain, for example, make some interesting legislation in Latin, which may reflect this kind of patriarchal, matrilineal pattern in their primitive Germanic society before they arrived in the Spanish Peninsula. Now, not surprisingly, polygamy arose, especially in patriarchal societies. Hunting-gathering societies are normally monogamous. The boy and the girl will get together when the glands have made them ready for the child-rearing job. They pair up and they usually remain mates for the rest of their lives. The lives of members of hunting-gathering societies are a lot longer than the lives of members of Neolithic societies. They have a healthier lifestyle and a healthier diet. They're on the move all the time. A lifelong monogamy seems to be the normal pattern for hunting-gathering societies. But there are exceptions. If, because of some disaster, many of the men get killed in conflict with a neighboring band, or they all go over a cliff while chasing a mammoth or something of that sort, and there's a terrific surplus of females to males, then the males are expected to mate with several females in order to keep the number keep the size of the band in steady shape. But basically, polygamy is aberrant and unusual in hunting-gathering societies. It becomes very standard in Neolithic societies. We wonder if matriarchal Neolithic societies that we postulate practiced polyandry, one wife and several husbands, as widely as male-dominated societies practice polygyny, one husband and several wives. Speculation, as always, finds little, if any, hard evidence on this question. And in any case, it seems likely that polygamy was largely a privilege of the ruling classes. In most of the polygamous societies that we can study, some men have many women, wives, concubines, whatever, slave girls. But many men have no mate at all. So polygamy tends to pull the available female childbearing population towards the privileged males and deprive the unprivileged males of it. It is thus, in the long term, genetically a very destructive kind of pattern. You may see initially people with particularly good genes are able to spread them widely thanks to polygyny. But after a while, that gene pool gets more and more restrained with the usual consequences. Class differentiation, in other words, by birth as well as by function, was an unmistakable feature of Neolithic life. And one of the prime differentiations between members of the upper class and the lower class was that men in the upper class had lots of mates and those in the lower didn't, had only one or possibly none. This may have operated for women too, but matriarchal polyandry had pretty much faded out by the time the historical record gets available to us. Perhaps the most far-reaching change occurred in the roles allotted to children. In a hunting-gathering society, there's practically nothing for children to do besides eat and play until they reach puberty. And suddenly with puberty, the signals click in. The boy and the girl find one another. They become mates. They stay mates for life. And they tend to have a limited number of children. Usually, the women do not get pregnant until every 5 years or so. This seemed kind of mysterious until DeVore's team went to work on the precise endocrinology, and they were able to relate lactation and ovulation and find that the normal nursing pattern of mothers in a hunting-gathering society meant that they did not get pregnant again until they stopped nursing when the child was about 4. So you have about a 5-year span between births. This, incidentally, makes for a great deal less sibling rivalry. When children are within 2 or 3 years of one another, infants are, they see, inevitably, they must see one another as competitors for the food supply. And this can start a kind of sibling rivalry, which becomes a very important kind of pattern, which reaches peaks, of course, in polygynous male societies, nomadic societies like those of the Mongols, in which you expect all of the boys of one generation to enter into terrible conflict, which will leave most of them dead and a few of them alive to carry on. This was certainly true of the Turkish, the family of the Turkish sultans, the great Ottoman dynasty, and is a very widespread kind of thing. Now, in a farming culture, there's plenty of work for the much more the many more children to do. They can start doing work even at an early age. Since Neolithic communities produced more children, they were more sedentary, different nursing patterns happened, pregnancy happened much more frequently. Since Neolithic communities produced more children than their Paleolithic or their Mesolithic hunting-gathering predecessors, these societies may have come to expect and even depend upon child labor. While the lot of most of the children worsened, approaching the status of slaves or work animals, and I think you can see how this also reinforces the differential class standing of certain families. Most of the children belonging to less privileged families had to work harder and harder, as hard as slaves or work animals. Some children, usually the children of the privileged families, were reserved for the privileged work, the elite work of education, put on ice, so to speak, and given extensive and, in terms of the economy of the time, expensive education. Not engaging in the normal activities of children or of young adults until a much more advanced age. And this certainly is a habit vividly alive today. Now, we can assume that the favorite offspring of ruling families had the best chance of being trained to become useful. Useful priests, useful warriors, useful craftsmen. Aristocracy, once entrenched, tends to preserve itself. It took the French Revolution to shake it in Europe. And that did not succeed in entirely getting rid of the European memory of nobility as a certain kind of inherited nobility, a certain kind of very important privileged myth, if you want. Class divisions must have hardened steadily, relieved only by two things. Polygamy, especially the polygyny of patriarchal societies, allowed women at any rate to rise from underprivileged class status to privilege. And if the circumstances were right and their luck was right and their personal interactions were right, then their children could participate in the privileges of the dominant class, although their parents had certainly not enjoyed those privileges. Occasionally, of course, exceptional individuals enjoyed upward mobility because of sheer skill in craft, sheer skill in aiming weapons. So thus, in hunting and in warfare, certain individuals could rise to a higher status, sheer strength, sheer brains. But this is the kind of pattern which would eventually push to the fore in the Industrial Revolution, making inherited class status less powerful than upward mobility. Sort of the model of the American upper class, the mythic model at least, is that it's based on talent rather than on inherited privilege. Now, all of these patterns were, of course, intensified when one group conquered another. Well, I think we can easily imagine the kind of conflict that got built into social relations where the values of matriarchal farmers had to accept the dominance of patriarchal nomadic values. If the ideal matriarchal male was probably supposed to be a responsible, self-effacing co-worker and a loyal mate to his wife who was equally industrious, who was clever, who was unshakable, an interesting kind of relationship indeed. Instead of that, the patriarchal male was admired for being adventurous, proud, and combative, a seducer and dominator of women whom he preferred to be docile and faithful rather than intelligent and ingenious and industrious. Hardworking, yes, but industrious, really industrious, suggesting the kind of hard work that leads to accumulation, that's a different kind of thing. James Mellart, the excavator of Çatalhöyük, has pointed out in the end of another book, a book he wrote called The Neolithic of the Near East, a fascinating book talking about this whole West Asian phenomenon, has pointed out that certain words in Greek are clearly derived not from the Indo-European stock of the rest of the Greek language, but are derived from an earlier layer of languages. And this is true also of the Semitic tongues, now Arabic, but of earlier Semitic tongues like Hebrew and Aramaic and so on, which were widespread in the area. Both of these languages, the Greek coming in from the north, from hunters, the Semitic languages coming in from the south, from nomadic hunters. Both of these languages picked up lots of words, words for places, words for plants, things of that sort. Also words for human types, for human ethical models, for human ethical values, which clearly come from an earlier stratum of language. And Mellart suggested, he pointed out that something that has been established by formal philologists, that many of the sort of pejorative words, the braggart, the bully, the lecher, the drunkard, and so on, in modern Greek, and apparently to a lesser degree also in modern Arabic, derive not from the Indo-European word store of the bulk of the Greek language or the Semitic word store of the bulk of the Arabic language, but therefore, presumably, from the dead languages of long vanquished Neolithic peoples who were presumably agricultural. We can imagine them maintaining the values of the matriarchal family, of the matriarchal unit, the couple, but having to live under the rule of these of a different kind of male role model. The pastoral conquerors of such peoples presumably didn't understand these terms of ethical disapproval, and so allowed them to slip into their own speech patterns. This is not a bad moral victory for the productive farming communities that changed the course of human culture, while their more mobile and bellicose neighbors, unfriendly neighbors, stole the glory.